Welcome to Headlines, Halakhic Debate of Current Events, a weekly interactive program on some of the most controversial breaking issues of today. Here now is your host, David Lichtenstein, founder and CEO of the Lightstone Group, and author of Headlines.
Welcome to Headlines, everybody. This week, our guest will be Rabbi Aryeh Leibowitz, the Rav of the Beis HaKnesses of North Woodmere. His topic will be shaking hands with somebody of the opposite gender. All of us who've been at work, or even those who don't work, have had this experience where, sometimes uncomfortable, where somebody from the opposite gender offers you their hand, or where you feel impelled to give yours, and you just don't know what to do. Is it, like some Paiskim will say, Yerig Val Yaver, or is it just an innocuous deed and its mutter? Next week, our guest will be famed author Rabbi Binyamin Ginsberg. He's an educator, and the topic will be a painful, sensitive topic: children at risk. Do we keep them at home, or we send them away? Something, sadly, that almost everyone we know somebody who has to deal with this issue. You can either listen to us at WMCA.com or on the radio WMCA or at NachumSiegel.com, and you can send your questions in to questions@headlinesbook.com. We're here with Rabbi Aryeh Leibowitz, the Rav of the Beis HaKnesses of North Woodmere. Welcome, Rabbi Leibowitz.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
So, Rabbi Leibowitz, what would you say if you were approached with what is today a very common occurrence that happens if you work in any business field? You're either a male or a female, and you're at a meeting, and somebody from the opposite gender approaches you, and in a very colloquially polite way, they reach out their hand and shake. What would you do? What's the halacha?
Well, as you mentioned, it's not just a hypothetical. These questions come up all the time. We get these questions all the time. And different poskim have different opinions on this question. So while I certainly have a certain mahalich that I received from my rebbeim, it's important to realize that different people hold different ways. There's a fundamental machlokas rishonim. If negia biderech chiba, if touching in an affectionate way with someone who one is forbidden to, is an issur d'oraisa or an issur d'rabbanan, but everyone agrees that it's certainly forbidden. The Shulchan Aruch paskins that it's an issur d'oraisa, like the Shitas HaRambam. So we're certainly dealing with a very sensitive issue, and what it really boils down to is what's called derech chiba or derech taiva, what's considered to be an affectionate kind of touching. So some poskim take a very strong stance, the Chazon Ish and the Stipler, that, and Rabbi Yamin Zilber and Shuvas Az Nidberu, that touching with a handshake, Rabbi Yamin Zilber I think even has such an expression that what difference does it make if you're hugging with the body or hugging with the hand, that's showing affection, that's showing love, and if that's the case, it's an abizrayu of Gilui Arayos and would be Yaharig Val Yaver in the most extreme view. Others say, you know, shaking a hand is a pretty cordial type of way to greet somebody. It's not, wouldn't it be called derech taiva? It's not, it doesn't have any implication of anything more than just being cordial and friendly. And we also have to balance that you don't want to embarrass somebody else. If someone sticks out their hand to you, if you don't respond in kind, or you sneeze into your hand, as Rav Scheinberg suggests to do, to sneeze into your hand, or do something like that, it could be embarrassing for the other party. So many other poskim suggest that you give a quick and a firm handshake, and then that would not be called derech chiba and derech taiva.
Well, Rabbi Leibowitz, as somebody who has seen, you know, TV shows, I can't remember when Rhett Butler or Scarlett O'Hara shook hands. And I, for the life of me, don't ever remember shaking hands with my wife. So can you even imagine any time in your life that you've seen in a romantic way two people shake hands as a precursor to any type of a conjugal relationship?
Never. And that's, in fact, the sheet of the Yezer Mikodesh. He says the definition of derech chiba is something that's going to bring about bia. It's going to bring about some type of very inappropriate interaction. And shaking hands generally is not, does not meet that criteria. And that's why many poskim hold that shaking hands would not be called derech taiva or derech chiba. But others say no, that the very act of shaking someone's hand, of touching someone in a friendly manner, is the beginning of chiba. Very often relationships start as friends and then turn into something else, or there could be hirhurim, a person shakes the hand, and if it's a woman that he's attracted to, he could have some sort of hirhurim, some sort of inappropriate or lewd thought.
So, Rabbi Leibowitz, let me just say, the lushan of the Rambam, is, this isn't the sefer mitzvahs, who is hiru mikiruv lechas mikal elu arayis, afilu b'lai biya, kagain chibuk v'neshika ha-daimelen, mipu'ulais haznus. How do you take the position of pe'ulais haznus on shaking hands?
It borders on
the absurd.
There are two girsos in that Rambam. Some have pe'ulais haznus, and some have pe'ulais hazaros, that things that are foreign to us. And interactions that involve touching, males and females touching, would be something foreign. I've never seen anyone actually make that deal and compare the two, but it does stretch the imagination a little bit to say that this would be considered znus. Now, the Rambam in the Mishneh Torah is generally where we paskin from, and he writes that chibek v'nishek derech taiva v'nehene b'kiruv basar, that you do it in a way that expresses some sort of taiva and you get pleasure from it. So depending on perhaps the number of sociological factors and what people are used to, some of the poskim thought that any sort of touching could be derech taiva and could be something that one would get hana'a from. Now, Rav Moshe Feinstein, for example, writes in a few different shuvos that he thinks it's aser, but people have reported, and this is all secondhand, that when they asked Rav Moshe, they were told that it's mutter. Now, in general, we don't like to listen to secondhand reports, but Rabbi Sturmbach in Tshuvas VaHanhagos in Chelek Dalit actually says that he responded to a shaila about this, and the person that he spoke to went to ask Rav Moshe, and Rav Moshe said you should do it in a way that's clear that it's not derech chiba. It shouldn't be a soft, slow handshake, a quick, firm, professional handshake. So we do have on good authority that certain poskim held that, and certainly Rav Salvechik held this way, my own Rebbeim, Rav Mordechai Willig, and Rav Herschel Schechter certainly hold this way, that a quick, firm handshake is very far from derech taiva in our society.
Okay, now, it's known that the stipler was the one who was particularly machmir on this.
Mm-hmm.
And he held that it was Yerig Val Yaver to shake hands with a woman.
Right.
Now, the stipler, and so stipler was asked by somebody. He says, if it's only a drabanan, which by the way, Ramosha says, even like the Rambam, in a case where it's in many of these cases would only be a drabanan, where it's only by noikfei aleihem, would be a drabanan. So he says, why wouldn't it be muta because of kavod habrius?
Yeah, so the it gets a little bit more touchy, if you'll excuse the pun, but when you're dealing with something that's related in even in just a very minor way to Giloy Arayos, there are sugyas toward the end of Sanhedrin that deal with what we call Abizrayu de Giloy Arayos, which is something that is somehow even mildly related to Giloy Arayos, and an Abizrayu of Giloy Arayos may also be Harig Val Yavar, even if it's a very low-level Avera. Now, Rav Moshe writes in his famous tshuva about subways, when it's you're getting on a crowded subway and there's no choice but to bump into people and to unfortunately, to be touching all kinds of people, men, women, whoever you're bumping into in the subway. So he says, it can't be that that's even an Isser Drabanan, because if it were an Isser Drabanan, we would never allow a doctor, let's say, to take someone's blood pressure if not for Makom Sakana. Rav Moshe does say, if it were makom sakana and it were only a drabanan, we would allow it. But he says, if it's not in an affectionate way, then it's not even an iser drabanan to begin with. Megia shalo b'derech chiba. It's ironic because the Gra points out that when one touches his own wife, if she's a nida, even shalo b'derech chiba, even in a non-affectionate way, would be aser. But we paskin touching other people, shalo b'derech chiba, in a non-affectionate way, would be heter gamur, it's completely mutter, it's totally permissible. So it would turn out that if you're on a crowded subway with your wife and you have to bump into somebody, and your wife is in need, it's better to bump into the other person than to bump into your wife. It's an ironic kind of twist that that would emerge according to Rav Moshe.
So, according to, but I want to point something out that when the stipler who answers it is asked this question, he says, you know, it's a question of gadol kavod abrius, and more than that, it could be malbum pnei chaveri barabim. The stipler answers, he says, well, the whole din of kavod abrius is when the other person is, it's when it's accidental, it's incidental kavod abrius. But he says, when the other person knows that they shouldn't be doing it, he says, then there's no kavod abrius. Adarabba, let them be shayma taira mitzvahs and do what they're supposed to be doing. So he apparently was being asked in the case where it was an Eretz Yisrael, where the other person was Jewish, and he considered that the other person was, I guess, a lahachasnik, or somebody who should have known the halacha, and where they're doing it, he says, there's no kavod abrius. But from the way the stipler answers, it would seem that if it was somebody who was either a tinnik shenishba, or certainly somebody who was not mechuyev in a guy, it would be mutter, even according to the stipler, in a case where there would be a kavod abrius.
Yeah, I think there are two factors that go into it. There's what the stipler himself articulates, which is, like you said, that it's that we don't worry about kavod abrius for someone who doesn't have their own self-respect to observe mitzvahs properly. And you're right, according to that, it would sound that if it's a person who should not have known better, that even according to the stipler, which again is the most extreme position, and it's not only the stipler, his brother-in-law, the Chazanish, also held this way, then even according to them, it should be mutter. But then Rav Binyamin Zilber, in the Chuvasaz Nidberu, who's also part of that camp, part of that line of thinking, suggests a little bit more. He gives you a little bit more of an insight into what the thinking was. And he says, you know, if you were to be in a place nowadays where hugging and kissing is the norm, and that's just the standard derech eretz that people express to each other, so he says, do you think you would ever say that it's mutter to be menashek arayos, to kiss people who are arayos? He says, yishtaka adover, can't be, such a thing can never be said. That would be, so you get the sense that there's a slippery slope concern over here as well.
Okay, let me...
There are a lot of poskim that I don't want to... I know because of the questions, I've been defending the position of the stipler and the chazanish. There are a lot of poskim, and not just contemporary poskim, not just my rebbeim, but a lot of great rabbanim who were lenient in this area. There's a story my rebbe likes to tell of Rav Shimon Shkap. Rav Shechter tells of Rav Shimon Shkap. Rav Shimon Shkap had a granddaughter who, I don't know if she was so frum or something, and she had a friend who came over to the house, and the friend was not religious at all. And the friend, she introduces her female friend to Rav Shimon, and the friend sticks out her hand to Rav Shimon. And Rav Shimon shakes the friend's hand, and after the friend leaves, Rav Shimon tells the granddaughter, you know, your friend doesn't know that it's inappropriate to stick out a hand to shake a man's hand. But I know that there's an isser of halbanas pnei chaveru barabin, that there's an isser to embarrass somebody. So I responded, I shook her hand because I don't want to embarrass somebody. And certainly there are a lot of poskim that certainly take that into account, the issue of embarrassing someone else. That's certainly a serious concern for many people. Rav Gustman even distinguishes. He says, if a woman sticks out her hand to you, then you're dealing with embarrassing her, and that you should respond to by shaking her hand. But if she doesn't initiate, then you certainly should not initiate a handshake.
And I was told by my father, Zecharon Livracha, that he heard from Reb Moshe that if the woman initiates, then al talbanus pnei chaveri, then you should respond, because then you have what to be saimecha, and I would imagine the din of either halbanus pnei chaveri, which is, you know, which is a derais, and it's more than that. The Aruch Haner says that on Halbanus Pnei Chaveri, there could be a din of Yarek Val Yavar on that as well.
Yeah, it's a Taisus and Saita says like that. And Daf Yud, the Gemara says that Tamar had the opportunity to embarrass Yehuda. Right. So Tosus asks the Kasha, if it's better to throw yourself into a Kivshan Eish than to embarrass someone, why don't we ever mention it on the list of things that are Yarek Val Yavar? So Tosus' answer is that since it's not an explicit Isser in the Torah, it doesn't make the classic lists, but Ein Achinami, it really is Yaharik Val Yavar. Rabbi Yona writes that way in Shari Tshuva, that it's also Yarek Val Yavah for a different reason. He says it's an abizrayu of ritzicha. It's like murder when you embarrass somebody because their blood drains. So it's like shvichus damim. So there is that shita in Rishonim. That
Achila sumka v'chaka chevra. So my father said that Ramosha said that if they don't initiate it, just why enter the situation? Why, you know, why posit an answer? But on the other hand, if the other person reaches out a hand, then you should. That was the Kabbalah.
Right.
That
now
I
the
had.
Problem with that one could run into is when you go for a job interview or you're trying to impress somebody and it's a very important meeting for one's career, certainly college interviews, the expectation sometimes is that you do initiate. And failure to initiate could sometimes make a negative impression. A person also has to weigh the gravity of the situation. A job interview is certainly a little more important than meeting someone socially, where you can more easily, politely decline. There are different circumstances. They say Rav Soloveitchik used to say to give the dead fish, to just stick out your hand and let the woman shake your hand without you doing the shaking. But from what I'm told from my Talmidim and my friends who are in the workforce, it's a little difficult for me to speak about because I never spent a day in the secular workforce. I've been teaching in yeshiva and a rabbi of a shul my whole life. But those who tell me that if you go, you try the dead fish, you're never going to get a job. That, it makes a terrible impression. Yeah. You know, Malcolm Gladwell has the book Blink, that in the first 3 seconds, they already made the decision. They already made the decision if you give the dead fish.
Yeah, you don't appear particularly commanding or right. Presumptuary or you know, control of the situation when you give a dead fish.
Yeah, I just had an interesting correspondence with Rav Yitzchak Zilberstein from Eretz Yisrael. I had a Talmud who was bringing his child for an ophthalmologist appointment, and it was a very high-end ophthalmologist, someone who was very chush of a doctor in Manhattan. And when they were in the office, they noticed that there were all sorts of tennis paraphernalia around the office. So his wife said to the woman, to the doctor, "You must be a big tennis fan." And she responded in a very cryptic way, and she was very curt with them. And it seemed strange. Her whole office was filled with tennis things. And they went home and Googled her, and it turns out that she wasn't really always a her. She grew up a nice Jewish boy from Forest Hills, according to her Wikipedia page, and she had once sued the USTA to be able to play on the women's circuit, and she lost. She lost the suit. She wasn't able to play in the women's circuit, and she's become like a champion of transgender rights or what have you. And the Talmud said, you know, normally when they go to a doctor with his wife and the baby, who, if it's a female doctor, he'll hold the baby and his wife will shake the doctor's hands, and if it's a male doctor, she'll hold the baby and he'll shake the doctor's hand. So he said, what do I do with this doctor? This person was born a boy but now looks like a woman, so what should we do? So I asked Rav Yitzchak Zilberstein what he thought, and he said, obviously the halacha is pretty clear that it's not a she, it's a he, that a person who's born a man can't change that. But I thought maybe there would be a concern of hirhurim or something like that. If she looks like, if the doctor looks like a female, then maybe it would be a problem of hirhurim for the man as well. Rav Zilberstein wasn't concerned with that at all. He didn't think that would be hirhurim for such a person, especially knowing what you know about the person.
Well, the Shulchan Aruch says that there would be a din of yichud even by two zecharim, except that ein echshav in alkach. But in
right.
An area where that they're chashid alkach, there is a din of yichud even on two zecharim. So you have an ish that turned into an isha. So it's not a gender thing. It's where there is it goes after
the
metzias, where the mindset is. So if it's an attractive person, the argument would be why would there not be a din of kurv al arayis, and for that matter, an isser of yichud too.
So I think Rav Zilberstein's impression was that from your perspective, knowing what you know and knowing that the person is really a man, he thinks that alone. He didn't say it in so many words. He used terminology that was more poetic. Or graphic, if you will, that the person is malei tzoa and has all sorts of issues. So he thought that from your perspective, you're not going to have any hirhurim. Now, from their perspective, in Achinami, it may be different. So maybe you could argue it's a lifneiver over here because it's a Jewish person, but I think someone who interacts on a daily basis with people of whatever gender and shakes everybody's hand, I think it's hard to say that it would be a lifneiver.
Now, additionally, when you mentioned that, you know, being a cultural issue, the Stiples Lushin is when he's challenged and he says, he's asked that shaking hands is not a derechiba. He says it's impossible that a person should shake somebody from the other gender's hands and not be aroused by it. Now, maybe this is B'nai Brak, but I think that somebody who works in the United States today, this is somewhat of a statement that we would disagree with.
Yeah, it's interesting because nowadays with instant communication, sometimes people in America feel like all of their shailas need to be answered in B'nai Brak. But that was never the tradition in Judaism. We have local rabbanim to deal with local issues. And when you get the big shailas of agunas and things like that that need to be dealt with by the Gedolei Yisrael, so that's when you send the shaila to someone like Rav Eliyashiv Zichrono Livracha or someone like, but in order to paskin a shaila that people deal with in New York, let's say, on a daily basis, you probably need to understand the New York scene a little bit more. You're probably better served with a Rav who understands the New York scene a little more. It's also interesting you mentioned the Stipler says that nobody would ever be able to shake a woman's hand without feeling some sense of hirhurim. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik had an interesting raya.
Well, let me just correct that because I'm on. It says let me read his language exactly. He says a sheker gomer ki lo yimolet sheish tzoyer yiga beisha v'la yigrim lo yishum chimam.
See, the Stipler was very careful with his lashon. He says ish tzoyer. The reason he says that probably is the Yerushalmi in Sota talks about the carbon that the sota would have to weigh.
And the kohen would pick up it says a kohen zakin would pick up the isha's hand.
Exactly. And the Yerushalmi says that there was no hirurim, not just because he was a zakin, but also because it was just a short amount of time. So that's where we get the idea that the brisk, quick, firm handshake maybe is not the rechiba, but the Stipler says an ish tzayir. That's very interesting. One might argue it really depends what the woman looks like also. If the woman is a young woman or an older woman, if she's an unattractive woman, my Rebbe has said that on occasion that he was once at a bank and the bank teller, the employee, wasn't a teller, the employee from the bank stuck out her hand and he felt that it was appropriate to shake her hand. She stuck out her hand and he did. And he said that in any event, it was someone that was not attractive at all. So he didn't think that it was. He didn't even think twice about it. I remember when we asked Rav Schechter once, "What do you think about the Stipler's Lashon Yaharig Val Yavar?" He just smiled and said, "That sounds like a little much. It's a little much."
But here's a question, Rabbi. We're speaking to Rabbi Arya Leibowitz, who is the Rav of North Woodmere. Rabbi Leibowitz, another question for you: If indeed the Rambam is meduyik b'lshayna and it's derech znus, and like he says in the Yad HaChazaka, derech taiva, and a handshake is neither a derech znus nor a derech taiva, and the person of the opposite gender is extremely attractive and there is hana, it shouldn't matter because it's still not a kirva l'arayis. It's not an isser it's not like electricity. It's like it's not an isser of mukta. It's an issa because it's a kirva to a raya. It will bring to something else. If it's not a derechiba, it's not an isser hana.
That's an interesting take. I mean, the idea that it is an isser because it will bring to something else, that's not that it does sound that way from the Rambam's formulation in Sefer HaMitzvos, but the Rambam Mishnah Torah sounds like it's not just about that it will bring to somebody else. It says, v'nehene b'kiruv basar, that you get hana'a from it. So if it's an attractive woman that a person is getting hana'a from, even in Rav Moshe's tshuvas about these things, you know, about the subway, he says, I'm assuming that you're not getting any hana'a from it. But if you're a person whose mind is in the gutter or you have, these kinds of issues, then you can't go if you're getting some sort of hana'a. It's not derech taiva to bump into a woman either on the subway, but if that's where the person's mind is, then one could argue that according to the Rambam, that would be called that he's being neh b'kiruv basar. The idea that you say, though, is a very powerful idea. Rav Yosef Engel has a whole essay, I think in Asfanda Araisa, where he describes the concept of what he calls a siyagda araisa. And normally we think of a siyag as a fence around the Torah, as something that the Rabbanan did, that when there's an iser to, let's say, grind on Shabbos, the Rabbanan make a siyag around that and say, don't even take medicine on Shabbos, lest you come to grind. Rav Yosef Engel suggests that maybe there's such a thing called the siyagda oraisa, that the Torah itself makes an iser in order to protect you from another iser in the Torah, that it's all a siyag for another iser in the Torah. And he gives this as one of the examples. The Shitas HaRambam, that Negia b'derech taiva is a siyag d'oraisa. It's a siyag to be a b'arayos. He has several other examples of siyag d'oraisa, like 15 other examples, but that's an interesting idea. I just don't know that. I could see how one could easily read the Rambam in Yisuri Bia saying that it's not about whether this interaction is going to lead to Bia, but once one is getting Hana'a by touching, that's similar enough to the Isser that would fall under this category.
But even the Rambam at the Yad HaChazakah, his Lashon is Klaimar, Le'sikrivu l'dvarim ha'meviyim lidei gilui erva.
Yeah. So Mevi'im can be in a number of ways. One could argue that by watching an inappropriate movie, it just puts a person in the wrong mindset and will be Mevi Lidei Gilui Erva. One could argue that it's not only about that this act will directly lead right now to an inappropriate act with this woman. It could be just in a broader sense that these are the kinds of things when a person has Hirhurim, and the Gemara says if a person tries to indulge his Yetzer Hara, specifically in this area too much, then the Yetzer Hara grows stronger. The Gemara has such an expression that if someone starves his Yetzer Hara in the area of Arayos, then the Yetzer Hara will be satiated. If you're Marivo, then it's Saveya, then it's satiated. But the more you indulge the Yetzer Hara, the more hungry it gets. One could argue that the Mevi'in Lidei Gilui Erva is in the broader sense.
By the way, it's not just the Lashon HaRambam. The Lashon of the Shari Tshuva is very similar. Lashon HaShari Tshuva Rabbeinu Yoin is Ki HaKreva Mevi Lidei Gilui Arayos. So it's the same siyug, that is. Let me ask you, I have some questions here that came in by email.
Okay.
Well, the sort of some are on point and some are not on point. If someone lives in Europe, we have somebody who lives in Amsterdam. It's Ellie from Amsterdam. If someone lives in Europe where the custom is to kiss cheek to cheek at business meetings, is that permitted?
Well, first I would tell anyone who lives in Europe right now to be safe and be careful, because it's very difficult to see all the anti-Semitism that's happening in Europe. But in terms of kissing in business meetings, it's a very difficult thing. I mentioned before, Rav Binyamin Zilber writes that if you're going to allow shaking hands, next thing you're going to allow is a kiss on the cheek. It's going to be mamish chibuk v'nishuk. It's very difficult to be makel in something like that, especially since we've been working so hard to be medayek in the Lashon of the Rambam, in the Shulchan Aruch, who quotes the Lashon of the Rambam, and the exact words that he uses to describe that which is asur is chibek v'nishek darach taiva. One could make a coherent argument that if it's not derech taiva, it's derech greeting, and that's just derech hanimus, that's just the way everyone greets everybody, men to men and men to women, that's just the way everybody greets everybody. One could certainly argue that it would not be considered derech taiva. I don't know if I have broad enough shoulders to say such a thing. I think that question has to be for bigger people.
Here's Mayor from Silver Springs. Can I go to the barber and get a haircut from a woman haircutter?
So I would think in that situation, it's also not derech taiva, and strictly speaking, it's mutter. Now, I don't know why a person, in all of these situations, we do our best to avoid them. We don't look for these kinds of situations. You know, where in Silver Spring, I assume that there are male barbers available. And if there's a male available, so I don't think it's a problem. I've been to many barbershops where there are lots of males, and still everyone waits for a particular barber. That, you know, that this is my barber that I'm comfortable with. So I don't think it's even a violation of Banas Panim if the woman is the next available barber, and to just pass it up. Technically, would it be forbidden? I don't think it would be technically forbidden, but we don't look to try to create these situations. And obviously, if a person has hirhurim from it, if he gets a wash or whatever, you know, there's more touching than necessary, and he has hirhurim from it, then it's a real problem.
But we do have the Shulchan Aruch that says Meshamshin Beisha. It says the Rama says you're even allowed to be bathed by a woman Mesham Shifcha. The Gemara at the end of Kiddushin. So, I mean, that's what we paskin, that So how would you juxtapose that halacha?
I don't know. That's why I seem to recall. I don't have a Shulchan Aruch in front of me. I thought the Shulchan Aruch says, Ein Mishamshin Bisha.
No, but the Rama says, our minig is the we are.
In what sense? I don't remember the context. What does he say?
Well, it's basically Tosfos. Tosfos at the end of Kiddushin says our minig is that mishamshin beisha, because it says that he used to hakol de shemayim. Right, the last gemara in Kiddushin, and he says our minig is the only the only area we were not hakol l'shem shemayim. The gemara on pebeis amar aleph in Kiddushin, al zenu saim chem hashdush and mishamshin benashim.
And that's what does that mean exactly? To be mishtamish benashim.
That means you're allowed. A woman is, the Shulchan Aruch says, allowed to bathe a person.
So I don't want to. I would have to look it up. But often when we talk about bathing, it doesn't necessarily mean that there's direct physical contact. Sometimes it means making a bath for a person, like in Hilchos Nida, that the issue of Nida. The things that in Nida is Asura Labaila, the Gemara in Ksuvis talks about. There are only two Gemaras in all of Shas that really discuss the Harchakos of Anida. So Harchatos Panav Yadav Raglav is mentioned in the Gemara in Ksuvis that Anida is not allowed to be Osa Labaila, she's not allowed to do for her husband. So many of the poskim understand that that means even if she's not touching him, that even that Harchatos Panav Yadav Raglav could mean to draw a bath even for him. So I'm not sure. I would have to look carefully at that Ramah.
Okay. Here's a question. Okay, well, this is a little bit off, topic, but is there a company? Is there a problem attending a company holiday party? It's Naomi from Flatbush.
So normally, the way they, from what I understand, again, I'm not in the workforce, in the secular workforce, but normally, the way I understand is most companies try to make it fairly parvis. They try to have a holiday party around the holiday season. It's not specifically held on the holiday. Everyone wants to be with their families on the actual holiday anyway. And it's just a way for the office to get together, and they hand out bonuses or whatever it may be. Now, the issues that you face, you do face several issues, not just being at the party, but certainly halacha, there are many halachas in place that try to limit the social interaction between a Jew and an Eino Yehudi. And certainly drinking together is a serious concern, lahalacha, so one shouldn't drink together at a holiday party. But you're going to go, and you're going to pick up your bonus, and you're going to say hello to your boss. I don't think that's a problem.
Okay, here's a question from Chaim from Lakewood. Eating a business lunch in a non-kosher restaurant, having a salad, or even not eating it, just poking it around, but I have to go there for business meetings, is that mutter or not?
Yeah, when I was growing up, we were always told, if you go into a McDonald's, it's Maris HaAyin. And then I grew up a little more, and I realized it's not really Maris HaAyin when you go into a McDonald's. There's two Yisurim. There's Mitzvah V'Yisem Nikiyim from Hashem Umi Yisrael, that one has to be above any reproach. One has to do things that others would not be suspicious that he's doing something wrong. That's chashad. That's not maris ha'ayin. Rav Moshe writes this way in the Tshuva, he's medayik. And maris ha'ayin would be not that people are going to suspect you of wrongdoing, but that people are going to see you doing something and think that it's mutter. Because they're going to see, oh, Ben Torah does that, it must be that's mutter. And they're not going to realize you're eating the kosher food. And they're going to think that the non-kosher food is kosher. And they're going to violate an avera by doing that. That would be maris ha'ayin. When a Jew walks into, let's say, a McDonald's, which is obviously not a place that they would have a business meeting, so normally if you're on the turnpike or something and you see a Jew walk into the McDonald's, you say, oh, that Jew must really have to use the bathroom. No one thinks that he's doing an avera. No one thinks that it's all of a sudden there's a kosher McDonald's. Generally speaking, that's the attitude that people have. I think similarly in many places, certainly in Manhattan, where business lunches happen all the time in all sorts of non-kosher restaurants, and it's fairly commonplace for kosher restaurants to actually deliver kosher food, packaged, double-wrapped, double-sealed, to the non-kosher restaurant, sometimes even with china to the non-kosher restaurant. If that's fairly common, it's difficult to say that it's maris ha'ayin. But you run into a whole bunch of other issues. It doesn't mean that everything's automatically okay. You mentioned having a salad. If you're having the salad from the non-kosher restaurant, even though the food is cold, you have to worry about bedikas tola'im. what kind of vegetables are in the salad, and are there bugs in the vegetables? Were they, so they certainly weren't checked for the way the halacha would require checking. You have to worry about a davar charis. Even if the salad is cold, maybe there are onions in the salad, and they cut it with a knife that's a non-kosher knife, and that would make the onions not kosher. So you have, and then if you're not going to wear a yarmulke because you're going to be in the non-kosher restaurant, so you don't want to cause a maris ha'ayin issue, you can't eat anything because you can't say a bracha without a yarmulke on your head. A person's not allowed to say a bracha without a yarmulke on their head. So it gets fairly complicated.
Okay. Here's a question from Aaron from Teaneck. I had to do a deal, a real estate deal, and the people owned a church. Can I enter a church building for a business meeting?
Very interesting. I once got a call from a Hasidish rabbi, a Hasidish rav, and he said, I need Rav Herschel Schachter's phone number. I said, what's the emergency? He said, my brother, who's also a Hasidish rav, got a shaila from a woman who won, an architect, who won the rights, the bidding, to build Mel Gibson's church. I guess Mel Gibson was a very religious man, and he was building a church, a famous Hollywood actor, and she won the rights to do it, and now she decided to ask a shaila. she allowed to take the job or not? What status does the church have? Does the church have a status of a Beis Avodah Zarah, where you're certainly not allowed to build a Beis Avodah Zarah, you're not allowed to walk into a Beis Avodah Zarah. Shulchan Aruch says you have to be marchik yourself from even the derech to a Beis Avodah Zarah. That goes to Avodah Zarah. So one could argue that it doesn't have a status, that although we paskin, and there's no doubt about this, that we paskin, that Christianity does have a status of Avodah Zarah, the religion, the actual worship, the actual observance of the religion has a status of Avodah Zarah. Even the Rabbeinu Tam, who suggests that perhaps, if you read the Rabbeinu Tam a certain way, that Goyim have no isur of shituf, of believing in a trinity maybe, or believing in some sort of partnership for God to have Chalila. Even according to Rabbeinu Tam, that's for a non-Jew. But for a Jew, it would certainly be Avodah Zarah. And we paskin like the Rambam anyway, who says that it's definitely an Avodah Zarah. The Rambam paskins Islam is not Avodah Zarah. Christianity is.
It has to be Avodah Zarah. You can't take the position that thousands of years of Eden, who were Maisa Nefesh by the Crusades and etc., died b'tayis. I think Rabbi Yankov Kamenetsky says that Anochi was given to the whole world. But Layilacha was only given to Klal Yisrael. So by the Umay Sa'ilam, they don't have a La'yilacha.
Right. But
so
we
they
do.
Don't have an, so but we us, do have. So for us, it's Avodah Zarah B'tachlis. You wouldn't say that the Kedoshim who all died by the Tzlav would die B'tayis. That would be a terrible thing to say.
Exactly. And you have it earlier than Rabbi Yankov. Other Achronim pointed out, Rabbi Yankov Emden pointed out, others pointed out that even if you're going to say there's no La'yilacha for a guy, but there is definitely for a Jew. And it's certainly Avodah Zarah for a Jew. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that a church is a base of Avodah Zarah, that it's that it would have a status of a base of Avodah Zarah. A base of Avodah Zarah normally is something that houses the Avodah Zarah. The church has various images, but none of them, those are all symbols. They're not really objects of worship. You go to a Buddhist temple or something like that, those are actual objects of worship very often. They're more than just symbols. But it could be that a church doesn't have a status of a base of Avodah Zarah. Be that as it may, I think the majority of poskim assume that to walk into a sanctuary of a church is a very significant problem, maybe a bizrayu of Avodah Zarah, and one should avoid doing. I remember Rav Schachter once commenting that we can never judge people who faced the horrors of the Holocaust, but in terms of those who hid away in churches and practiced as Christians during in order to avoid getting killed. We can't judge them because who knows what we would do in that situation, but it's not so pashut that halachically one wouldn't have to get killed in that situation. Now, there are a lot of things that go on in the church that have nothing to do with the church and that aren't even in the sanctuary. There are a lot of business meetings. Well, it's not normally a business meeting. Normally it would be voting, or I once had a Shaila Talmud called me. He was frantic. He called me up and he said, Rebbe, I don't know what to do, My brother is a drug addict, and he has been in Narcotics Anonymous for a while now, and he's getting better, and he's on the mend, and he's having some sort of ceremony for X number of time, whatever the amount of time that he's clean. And my mother and myself were supposed to attend the ceremony and show him support. And I was just given an address, and here I am. I'm driving to the address, and I called my mother to tell her I'm being a little late. And she said, oh, the entrance to the church is on 45th Street or whatever. He said, church? Church? He didn't know it was in the church. He said, what do I do? Am I allowed to go in? So I said, I think in that situation, they're probably not having the ceremony in the sanctuary itself. It's probably you're going through a side door. And that's why she told them the entrance is on the side street. You're going in through a side door where all sorts of different things happen. I think voting in churches they had in many places, no one had a problem.
And let's not forget bingo.
Right. Well, JCC took care of that also. So we were able to make our own bingo games.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Rabbi Aryeh Leibowitz, the most articulate and brilliant Rabbi Aryeh Leibowitz. We've for many years enjoyed your Daf Yomi Shiurim, and it's nice to hear you expound on these halachic topics that are so very nageya bizmanenu. It was an honor and a pleasure to have you on with us. Thank you so much, Rabbi.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And I just want to add, thank you so much for that sefer for headlines. I bought it as soon as it came out, and five of my balabatim bought it for me because they knew how much I would love it. So I started giving it out myself. But it's right up my alley. Beautiful, beautiful, clear and articulate sefer. Wonderful sefer.
Thank you. As an author, I've learned that, you know, it's amazing how flattery never worked for me. The minute I became an author, it worked like plasma. Thank you so much. It was an honor to talk to you.
My pleasure.
Cult of a good year. Bye-bye. So this week we read about Mechiyah Samalek, the Shulchan Aruch Paskins, that everybody has to go to shul, and here's Chira Samalek. Even women go to shul, even though it's Machoik Sapaiskim, most women are noig to go to shul. And my question is, who is Amalek? Right? Why do we go to shul? We read about it, and on Purim, we bang by Haman, which is to commemorate the destruction of Amalek. Who is Amalek? Are they out there? I mean, have you ever met an Amalekite? I mean, I know somebody who was going through a divorce. He told me that his wife's lawyer was Amalek. I don't think halachically that's correct. So if there's nobody out there that you can really hate as an Amalekite, and there's nobody to kill, I mean, what is all this banging about? Is Amalek really relevant today? Or are we just commemorating some, you know, way out there historical event? Now, some people will say that Amalek represents, you know, pure evil, like Hitler, Saddam Hussein, ISIS. These are Amalek. You know, unadulterated evil, irredeemable evil. But I don't believe that that's correct. Because if we think that Amalek is irredeemable evil, it's a metaphor, it's a mashal for like just this pure evil, and that's what they represented, the Hitlers of this world. In a way, isn't that like giving them a get-out-of-jail-free card? If we look at somebody like that and we say, you know, they were just born under a rock, the evil rock, what are we saying? We're saying they're not responsible for their actions. I mean, when we look at a rattlesnake, when you go to the zoo and you see a rattlesnake and it's hissing at you, do you say, oh my gosh, that snake is evil? Of course you don't. That's its nature. It was born to bite. When we look at a ferocious tiger that would, you know, if the glass wasn't there or the bars weren't there, would pounce on somebody, do we say that's evil? We say, no, that's Hashem made it. That's their nature. So if we believe that there is people out there that are pure, unadulterated evil, so we're saying basically they're not responsible for their actions, and that's a terrible thing to say. It's a kfira in free will. I mean, we all believe in free will. If we go down that path, it's a very slippery path. Because once we deny free will and we say bechira and we say there is a concept of people who are just the psychopaths and they have no free will, well, maybe each of us have a touch of that and therefore I can get away with, you know, a little bit of theft and a little bit of, you know, this and a little bit of that because genetically I also have in me just a little touch of that and I don't really control it. So it goes against the whole concept of we are responsible for our deeds, the concept of din v'cheshbin. So it brings us back to Who is Amalek? Are they really relevant today? We're just commemorating something from 3,500 years ago, or in the case of Haman, of 2,500 years ago. And what is their message? Like, what does Amalek stand for? Now, there are, by the way, there are religions that are called Manichaeism or Gnosticism that believe that there's a concept that the world is divided into black and white, and they believe that there was a good God. You know, many philosophers struggle with, why does evil happen in the world? Why does Ra happen? If Hashem, if God is Kulei Tov, why does evil happen at all? And they said, well, there's a good God and there's a bad God, and everything, something bad happens, it's from the bad God. The Gemara calls it Shtei Rishuyos. It's a type of kfira. We don't believe that. And they say that evil people come from that other side, from the dark side, the Sitra Achra. But it's really Shtei Rishuyos. It's another part. The Gnostics believe that. The Manichaeans believe that. We don't believe that. So again, let's come back to it. What is all this banging that we're doing? Who is the real Amalek? What is Amalek? And what does Amalek represent today in our lives? Now, here's another proof that Amalek doesn't represent something that's pure evil. And where is that? Let's see. Who is Amalek born from? Who are the parents of Amalek? Amalek was the son of Eliphaz and Timnah. And what do we know about them? Eliphaz was the son of Esav, right? And it says about Eliphaz, Rashi says, when he went to kill Yaakov, he caught up to Yaakov. He was a great warrior. He was fast. And he comes to Yaakov and he says, my father said I should kill you. And then he turns to Yaakov and he says, but I can't. I grew up in the house of Yitzchak Avinu. He was Mishamish Yitzchak Avinu. Rashi says he grew up on the knees of Yitzchak Avinu. He says, how could I possibly kill? So we see there was a great spirituality. There was something great about Eliphaz. He went against his father, and he refused to kill Yaakov. Now let's see Timnah. What do we know about Timnah? Rashi says about Timnah, he brings a Chazal, that Timnah came from royalty, came from the kings of Seir, and she said she was Misavil Izdabik B'Avais. She wanted to marry into the royalty of the Avais. She wanted to join the great genealogical line that would be Malchus Beis David, that would ultimately be the Mashiach. So she said, I couldn't marry into him. So she married Eliphaz, which was the closest she would get to the Shvatim. So she married the son of Esav. So here are two people who really had great intents to them, and their child is Amalek. So anybody who tells you that Amalek is irredeemable evil, achrisei adi'ayve, there's nothing good to them, etc., they're disrespecting the fact, the way the Torah sets them forward. So it brings us back to the fact, who is Amalek and what do they stand for? And how is it relevant to us that it's such a mitzvah, schir, we run to shul and we read the Torah, we read zecher, and we talk about it, and there's all kinds of mitzvahs, and we with a minion, and we come back again, and in the middle of the year, if it's an ibiyar or on kisetse, we say it again. So what is the message of Amalek? So think of it. Amalek comes four times in the Torah. There's four mentions of Amalek. The first time of Amalek is right before Kabbalah Satira. The Jews leave Egypt, and they're about to receive the Torah, and they're about to enter Eretz Yisrael, to enter the promised land, and it would be the Tikkun HaGomer. It's going to be the end. Everything's going to be perfect. And just before this magical moment, along comes Amalek. That's the first time we see Amalek. When's the second time Amalek? In Tanakh, Shaul, we're about to build the first king, about to build the Beis HaMikdash. We're going towards building a Beis HaBchira. Who comes along? Amalek. We want to build a sanctuary. Hadoim Raglav, the purpose of the Makim of Hashras HaShechina B'Olam Hazeh, Hashem's temple, Amalek comes along. When's the third time Amalek comes? The Beis HaMikdash was Nechrav. We're about to go back to Eretz Yisrael. Ezra and Nehemiah are going to take us back. Who comes along? Haman and Amalek. The end of the 70 years of Gullus, Amalek comes again. And when is the last time? It says right before the last Beis HaMikdash will be built, Ki Yadol Keiska, Amalek will come along and say, no, don't build it. So it seems every time there's a blossoming, there's right about to be a breakthrough. We're about to rise to the next level of what we've wanted to achieve our ends, Amalek is there to say, no, 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 you can't do it. Now the question is, what is it about, what is it in life that prevents us from making those breakthroughs? Think of it. Every seed wants to be a flower. Every acorn wants to be an oak tree. It's natural within us to want to grow to our fullest potential. What is it in me and you that prevents us from reaching our potential? What stops it? What holds us back? And I think most of us would say, it's fear of one type or another. I mean, there are lazy people, but even people who are really resourceful and want to, what holds us back? It's fear. And there are two different types of fear. The most common fear is, you know, I'm just not good enough. I'm not smart enough. I'm not capable enough. I'm not lucky enough. They're smarter than me. They're faster than me. They're taller than me. They're shorter than me. They have more resources. They're going to laugh at me, etc. All the different reasons, all the excuses. The dog ate my homework. The school is too hard. I wasn't born in the right month of the year, I got into the wrong class, my parents sent me to the wrong yeshiva, to the wrong school, I wasn't educated right, I was born at the wrong time, the jobs, I wanted to go into technology, I didn't have that opportunity, I wanted to get into this yeshiva, they rejected me, my teachers were wrong, my family, my siblings didn't respect me, it's endless, but I'm not good enough, that's one reason. And there's another possibility, and that is, I really am good enough. But as good as I am, it's just too high. I mean, I'm really capable, but that goal, it's really too big for almost anybody. You have to be on such a high level. Even a really accomplished person can't do that. I mean, you want me to give a speech over there? Do you realize the augustness of that position? I mean, do you realize how you know, accomplished you have to be that even really a very healthy and a thorough and a successful person couldn't do that? It's just too august. Now look at Amalek, right? He comes from, the parents are Eliphaz and Timnah. What does Timnah mean? To be monea means to hold back, restraint, hesitation. Rashi says Timnah was not the wife of Eliphaz. She was the Pilegesh. What did she say? She said, I'm just not good enough to be his wife. I mean, my father was a prince. I come from royalty. But Eliphaz's wife, I don't measure up to be a good wife. Do you know what it is to be the wife of Eliphaz? I mean, I'm not good enough. I don't cut the mustard. I'm not enough of a hostess. I'm not tall enough. My hair is the wrong color. I don't cut it. So she hesitated. She restrained. She refrained. She held back. To be monea, she just refrained. She kept. She was diminished, and she did not burgeon. She didn't reach her potential. And what does the word Eliphaz mean? Eliphaz is keli puz. Puz is kinechmadim mizav umipazrav. It's the purest, the most finely spun, the most beautiful gold. He's saying, my God is the most pure, the most exalted, transcendent. And what's he saying? How can I ever achieve that? How can I ever be of service to such a God? I mean, he's so on high. He's so removed from me. He's so much better than I can ever be. And what do these two fears give birth to? These two fears give birth to Amalek. And what is Amalek? Amalek is that power that says every time we are about to take on some new opportunity, break through, get into something we've always wanted to, we say, I can't. I just can't go wrong. I remember when I was left yeshiva, I was married, and we were just about to have our second child, and I had to go to work, and we didn't have a penny. And I didn't have any education in the working world either. And I decided to go into real estate because I said, you know, it's a field that an idiot could understand. It's sort of simple. You know, you add up the numbers, the rent, the income, the expenses, and you know if you're making money or you're losing money. And I came home and I told my wife, I said, you know, Shiffy, I'm going to work tomorrow because I don't want to borrow money and we can't pay the bills. And she said, what are you going to do? And I said, I'm going to go into real estate. And you know what? It was scary. I had rent to pay every month. I had bills to pay every month. And I had no education. And inside of me, I mean, I knew that there was an acorn. I knew we had the ability. I know there was something inside of me that was just exploding to come out. But the other side of me, there was those voices that were saying, what are you? How can you do this? What's your knowledge base? What's your experience? I mean, you come from such a family of scholars. I don't think there's been a businessman in your family since Adam, since Adam Arishan. But what's the solution to these fears? Look at the Pasuk. What does the Pasuk say? It says, Amalek came at the end of Bishalach, and he, Vayavai Amalek, Vayilachem im Yisrael berafidim. It says, he came when they were weak. When do these fears always come? They always come when we're down. They always come when we're vulnerable. They never come when we're happy. And what does it say? Vayomer Mishael Yeshua, battle, go to battle. We have to battle these fears. They don't go away by their own. You got to sit down and tell them, I will beat you. I know I can. And how do you do it? V'haya kasha yara maisha yaday. Two ways. One way is just jump into action. Don't sit there and reason and back and forth. You can reason. But ultimately, it's do. But what does Chazal also say? V'chi yadav shel Moshe ha'ises mochama. It has to do with faith. Every time he raised his hands, they looked klapei ma'alo, they looked at Hashem. So it's two things, the Pasuk says. How do you defeat these voices in your head, these Amalek? It's doing and believing. It's knowing that we were put here for a purpose. You were put here for a purpose. You and I, we are that acorn that is supposed to become that oak tree. So by doing, we are fulfilling our mission. We were meant to create and to build. We are seeds. We are meant to become flowers. Amalek is what's trying to prevent us. So we have to use our hands. V'haya kasha yarem yadav maishes yadav. And look klape maila and say, Rabbeinu Shalom, I believe that I will be successful. I believe you put me here to be successful. You put me here to move me to a higher place, to a better place, to become that mighty oak tree. That is my purpose. Next week we will have Rabbi Binyamin Ginsberg. He will be speaking about children at risk. Do we keep them at home? Do we send them away? Such a painful and difficult topic, but he's a noted educator and author. He's the expert on this topic. I look forward to hearing from you. Thank you so much. Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Headlines, Halakhic Debates of Current Events with David Lichtenstein, founder and CEO of the Lightstone Group and author of Headlines. Please join us again next week for another edition of Headlines.